Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
In Daniel chapter 6 today, there's been a change of empires from chapter 5 to chapter 6. We're going to pick up with 530 and deal with the transition from Belshazzar to Darius. Belshazzar is the last Neo-Babylonian co-regent into Darius. Now, there's going to be some historical problems here because of lack of information. We have a lot of information from archaeology, and it's so helpful to us to have this because every time archaeology has made a significant find, the historicity of the Bible has been corroborated. But there are still some areas where there's some questions. Now, when it says, the same night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king. Now, Chaldeans, of course, another name for Neo-Babylonian. It can be a racial group, or it can be a group of wise men like Daniel, chapter 2, verse 2. The Magi of the New Testament were Chaldeans. Now, Belshazzar has not been found on any of the Babylonian list of kings. And for years, everybody said, well, the Bible just made him up, this handwriting on the wall and all this. Well, we have found some more archaeological evidence, and we found that the king was Nabonidus. But he had got involved with the moon god Zen and had gone to her holy city and left Belshazzar as co-regent. Now, we're going to make a transition. The transition occurred suddenly. Cyrus diverted the river that went through Babylon and went under the walls where the river had run and captured the city without any bloodshed at all. Now, we know that from history. Cyrus, the new Medo-Persian ruler. But here we have a man named Darius. There's been a lot of fight over that. Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Now, we know there's a Darius the First, Hastrapes, who reigned in the Persian Empire after Cyrus. Matter of fact, he reigned from 521 to 485 B.C. So that obviously can't be this Darius here, because this Darius, we have more information about his background, his age, than any other of the historical people in Daniel. So it's obvious he's a historical person. Well, who could he be? Well, there's been several theories. Many times in the Bible, people go by several names. They go by their regular name. When they become leader, they go by a throne name. Sometimes they even have two throne names. Example would be in Esther, the Bible calls him Ahasuerus, but history calls him Xerxes. Moses' father-in-law is known as Jethro, Jether, Hobad, Ruel. And so it's possible there's a multiple name. So it may have been Cyrus by a different name. We're not sure. Some look at chapter 6, verse 28 to back that up. Others say that what we have here is Gobryas of Gudium. Now, he was the governor that Cyrus placed in charge of Babylon, and maybe that's the answer here. Now, further etymological research into the name Darius has revealed in the Izvestia, which is the Persian scriptures, that the word D-A-R-A is used for royal one, a title like Pharaoh or Caesar or Hadad, and maybe that's what Darius is, a title for Cyrus there. History is just silent, and we can't make any more dogmatic evidence on the information we have, but every other historical problem has been worked out the more archaeologists know, the more historians find, the Bible's historicity is proved. So I'm just going to have to put a hold on this for certain till later. Notice it says, receive the kingdom. Now, it's either received it by God or he received it by Cyrus. Now, chapter 9, verse 1, and chapter 6, verse 2, where it mentions the king may not suffer loss, that may refer to Cyrus. Cyrus is mentioned in 9:1, and some have thought that's what is happening here. Chapter 6, it seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps. Now, we're not certain exactly what a satrap is, and so it's inappropriate to say there were too many of them for the kingdom of Babylon. We're not sure what governmental structure they had exactly and how many they needed, okay? And over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might become accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel is somewhere but in his later 80s and probably close to 90 at this time. Now, he served a long time. Then this Daniel began to distinguish himself, and that's always been the example of Daniel. The spiritual gifts have just brought him to the forefront, and that's what caused the problem to the three young children back in chapter 3, and that's what's going to cause problems to Daniel. There's some racial prejudice, there's some administrative jealousy, and it's going to come to the head in chapter 6, as it did in chapter 3. Okay? Among the commissioners and satraps, because he possessed extraordinary spirit, that's a little s, not a capital S, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. It's going to be like Joseph in Egypt. Then the commissioners and satrap began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to the government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Not only was Daniel a gifted political leader, he was an honest political leader. And so they realized in verse 6 that they're going to catch him. They're going to have to catch him in relation to his religion. Now, they knew, because Daniel's lifestyle was consistent, that he prayed 3 times a day in his own home, in private, not in public, in private, facing the ruined, destroyed city of Jerusalem. And so they come in verse 6, and notice it says, the commissioners and satraps came by agreement. Now, this word literally means came tumultuously, or came in harmony. From the Psalms, we know this very same word is used for a conspiracy, and that's obviously what they're doing. Now, they came to the king Darius in verse 6 and 7. They're going to flatter him and say, why don't you make it where no one can pray to anyone but you? And anybody has a petition, they have to come to you. Now, Darius, as most political leaders are, had a great sense of his own importance and got caught in this egotistical trap that he later regretted so much. But he got caught in this. Now, some of us have wondered about him. In a sense, he was saying no prayer is what he was saying. Now, that seems funny because he would be a Zoroastrian. And they had an ultimate dualism, good and evil. It was Ahura Mazda was the good god and Angra Mayenta was the evil god. And so it seems funny that he would do this, because we never see the Persian rulers expressing deity like we see in later Rome and in Egypt and possibly with Nebuchadnezzar in Neo-Babylon. Now, so they set the king up, and boy, he fell for it, hook, line, sinker. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Now, this law of the Medes and the Persians is something we know about from history. A king, once he signed a decree, could not change it. Now, he could write another one that counteracted it some way, but he could not change what he had written. We see that in Esther chapter 1, verse 19, and Esther chapter 8, verse 8. Now, depending on if the man is racially a Mede or racially a Persian, it's called the law of the Medes and the Persians, or later on in Esther, it's called the law of the Persians and the Medes. And you can tell it's kind of like Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Is it Fort Worth-Dallas or Dallas-Fort Worth? There's a big fight over that for a long time. Same kind of thing here. And so he signed the document. Look at verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew the document was signed, he wasn't caught off guard. He wasn't surprised. He knew what was going to happen, but he would not change his commitment to God, his lifestyle of faith, simply because of a new law. Now, my brothers and sisters, we're going to have to decide in this area of government. Romans 13 tells us we're to obey the government. We need to obey the government in everything that's not crucial to our personal relationship with God. But there comes a time when government cannot step over the bounds. I think Jesus' parable about the coin and whose inscription on it and pay unto Caesar that which is Caesar and to God that which is God is laying the foundation work that we must be loyal ultimately to God, but that does not give us a license to be disrespectful or disobedient to earthly government. Daniel is not trying to flaunt his violation of the law, but he is not going to change his faith in God that he had kept through all these 80 or 90 years because of this little king's decree for 30 days. Now, he goes into his own house. And notice it says, now on his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. Now, most of the houses were flat, and they built a little bitty room up on the roof with windows around it. Now, this was their summer home. It was much more cool there. The breeze blew through. But Daniel used this for a place to pray 3 times a day. The morning sacrifice, the evening sacrifice, and probably sometime around noon became the traditional times in the Babylonian and Palestinian Talmuds. And that's what, maybe because of Daniel, gave credence to that. I don't know. But he did it 3 times a day. Now, notice it says, toward Jerusalem. Now, modern Muslims face toward Mecca when they pray. Well, there is even some examples in the Bible of Jews doing this quite often. Let me give you a few. 1 Kings 8, 44 and 48. 2 Chronicles 6, 34. Psalms 5, verse 7. Psalms 28, 2. Psalms 138, 2. And Jonah, chapter 2, verse 4, where they paid toward Jerusalem. It was even more significant here because Jerusalem was in ruins at this time. And yet Daniel believed the God that was with him is the God that restore the covenant, and Jerusalem was significant. Even in the state of ruins, Daniel faced that way and prayed. And thus says he prays on his knees, three times a day on his knees. We might well see Psalms 55, 17, and 18 for the three times a day still. But you know, the normal Jewish position for prayer is the eyes and hands lifted. This was the normal position. So whenever we see a different position, it's unusual for emphasis. The kneeling may have been a sign of special commitment. We see it several times in the Bible. 1 Kings 8, 54, Psalms 95, 6, and Isaiah 45, 23, and of course Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now I think in Gethsemane, Jesus was prostrate more than kneeling. But again, we see a change of position for emphasis, okay? Praying and giving thanks before his God. He was giving thanks to God even though he was a captive in a foreign land. Maybe he had even been made a eunuch. Here he was being politically persecuted and about to be thrown in the lion's den, but he was not controlled by circumstance. He was controlled by his faith in the ultimacy of God and his will for his life. Friends, I want to tell you, if your life is in jeopardy of circumstance, you're always in a flux, always in a twitter, always in a fluctuation, because our faith needs to be in God who made heaven and earth and controls our lives. Now, notice if you would where it says, "And these men came by agreement," same word up there used for tumultuously, "and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God." Now, either they broke into his home and were hiding in a closet or something, or they were looking across the street in a window, but they had set him up. He knew it, but he still went to God in prayer. Okay? "And they approached and spoke before the king about the king's petition. Did you not sign the injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast in the lion's den?" Well, the king is beginning to realize that he had been had. Now, throwing him in the lion's den was a common way of death. Just as burning people earlier or tearing them to pieces, these have all been in Daniel earlier, the lion's den was a common way in the palaces of the eastern and near eastern potentates to have people killed. "Then he answered and spoke before the king answered and said, 'The statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, and they may not be revoked.' Then they answered and spoke before the king, 'Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah,'" catch the racial prejudice. Now Nebuchadnezzar had started this by bringing all these different racial groups in to have them servant, to kind of show off the people that he controlled. And they had been jealous about the Jews clear back in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's time in chapter 3. And now they're throwing this back up in the king's face. "This Jew over here won't do what you say." And that's the whole inference here. "Pays no attention to you, O king, or your injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day." It was a significant lifestyle habit. "Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him." Now, he could not change the law, but he was trying, like Ahasuerus or Xerxes and Esther, to make another law that allowed Daniel to escape the penalty. But he just couldn't figure it out. There was no way for him to do it. The king was upset. He knew he'd been tricked, and he was angry with the men who tricked him, but he was heartbroken over this older man who had been such a faithful servant. He was going to make him leader of the whole realm, and now they tricked him into throwing him in the lion's den. "Now, then the men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, 'Recognize, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king established may be changed.'" The king was trapped by his own laws. "Then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast in the lion's den." Now, from the description of Daniel chapter 6, it seems the lion's den was a pit in the earth with apparently an excavated lower entrance. Now, that seems to fit it. This is an 80 or 90-year-old man. The fall should have killed him. It's just like Shadrach and Meshach being thrown the top of the fiery furnace. The fall should have broke their neck. They put the stone back over and waited till morning. Had to stay in there at least one day. "And the king spoke to Daniel, Now, my New American Standard in verse 16 has, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." But other manuscripts have, "May your God, whom you always serve." And I think the "may your" is a better than the affirmation that I have in my New American Standard. "And a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring." Remember, that's that special ring of the empire, and you put it in hot wax, just like the Romans sealed the tomb of Christ, the same kind of deal. It was a royal decree, and that's that kind of thing. "He sealed the stone and with the signet ring of his nobles so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the whole night fasting." This is not religious fasting. He's just fretting that he did something dumb. His best political man, his best administrator, is about to be killed. He can't do anything about it. That's what he's fretting about. "And no entertainment was brought him." Now, this is a very difficult Hebrew word. We really wonder what it means. Through history, there have been several theories. Number one, Eben Ezra, which is a Jewish interpreter, and John Calvin say this rare Hebrew word comes from the root to strike. And it means musical instruments. Now, others, like the translation, the Syriac translation, or the translation of Theodore, has the word food. No food was brought to him, picking up on the word fasting. Now, Martin Luther and the Revised Standard Version, because of the use of the word entertainment, usually have it pleasure or diversion. Now, the Jerusalem Bible has the sexual idea of concubines. Knowing the ancient court, any one of these could have been right. So the king spent a restless, lonely night. That's what it's talking about, okay? And sleep fled from him. He had insomnia. And the king rose at the dawn, and at the break he went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the lion's den, he cried out with a troubled voice. Do you catch the real pathos of this man? The king spoke and said, "Daniel! Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Now see what's happened. Just as Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3 said, "No one can deliver you from my hand," he put God to the test and God delivered him. So this king, in saying, "Was your God able?" was putting God to the test, and God was sure going to do it to prove who he was. Now, I think it's beautiful here when it says the living God. That is the root idea of the word Yahweh, Y-H-W-H, which is the covenant name for God. It's from the Hebrew verb to be. We see it first explained and revealed in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, to Moses at the burning bush. If I could paraphrase it, it means the ever-living, only living God. Now, this beautiful phrase, "to be, has he been able to deliver you?" I love the title of God, "He is able." I love the prayer of Jude, "unto him who is able." I want to tell you, God is able. He is active in our lives on a daily basis. And anything he can do, but like the three Hebrew children, we can't pull his string and say, "You got to." He's able to do it if he chooses to. And he chose to save them and Daniel. You might want to see chapter 3, verse 17, chapter 3, verse 29, Romans 16:25, Ephesians 3:20, and Jude 24 for the other uses of the God who is able. I want to tell you, ring your bell, look up those in the New Testament, see what God's able to do in your life through Jesus Christ. Man, it'll help you go up in holy smoke right there, I want to tell you. Now, in verse 21, Daniel spoke to the king, "O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth." Wow. Now, here we have an example of a guardian angel. There's a lot of angels in Daniel. There's national angels. There's individual angels. I think the Bible does teach guardian angels. I do not understand their function in the presence of an indwelling Holy Spirit, but angels minister to Jesus Christ, God incarnate, and apparently we have them too. You might want to see Matthew 18 and Acts 12:15. For being shut in the lion's mouth, you might want to see Hebrews chapter 11, verse 33, and one of the interbiblical books, 1 Maccabees, chapter 2, verses 59 through 60. If you've never read 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Maccabees, you ought to. They have some very good history, okay? Now, the king was so excited and pleased, he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him because he had trusted in God. Notice it wasn't because he could jump good. It wasn't because he knew how to manage lions. It's because he trusted in God, the very same thing that saved Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in verse 24, the king reacts. And those who tricked him, he brought those men, and he cast them, their children, their wives, in the lion's den. And before they reached the bottom of the lion's den, the lions overpowered and crushed all their bones. It wasn't the lions weren't hungry. It was the power of God. Now, I want to talk a minute about the Hebrew concept of corporality. That's what we have here. These men tricked the king, but their children and their wives paid the price with them. It's very hard for us in modern America that is so geared toward individual freedoms and responsibilities to recognize the corporate responsibility of the ancient world. It's hard for us to even understand the loyalty to a king in England, much less an ancient king like in Israel, and what that meant, the solidarity of that group. Original sin is caught up in the Hebrew ideal of corporality. Adam sinned, and all mankind sinned in him is one good example. Another would be Joshua chapter 7, where Achan took something out of Jericho that was under the Korban, and the Israeli army lost the battle the next day, and some men lost their life because of Achan's action. If you remember Joshua chapter 7, they found it was Achan, asked him to confess, he did. And Achan was stoned. Achan's wife was stoned. Achan's children were stoned. Achan's cattle were stoned. Now, his wife may have known about it. His kids may have heard about it and not told. But Achan's cows, that is a symbol of Hebrew corporality. We have one more example of that in Esther chapter 9, verses 10 through 13 that you might want to see. Now, the question has come in verses 25, 26, and 27, because the king makes such glowing statements about God. Was this king a believer? Well, we must go back to Nebuchadnezzar's statements in the presence of God's power, found in Daniel chapter 2, verses 46 through 48, and Daniel chapter 3, verses 28 and 29. I think these men were overcome at the extraordinary personal power of God in the lives of these men. But apparently they just gave lip service to it, and it was not something that changed their life, because the god Marduk is mentioned earlier in Nebuchadnezzar's life. This man apparently remained a Zoroastrian. We don't think it affected their theology. They just included one more god in their pantheon. They were just astounded and willing to make these great statements, but it wasn't a faith commitment. You know, there's folks like that in our world today. They're willing to say God is great and He's the only creator and He's the only one and He's the ultimate. Friends, it's not what you say about God that makes you right with Him. It's putting your personal trust in Him and His promise. And His ultimate promise was that He's going to send the Messiah to die in our place. It's knowing God that makes us right with God, not knowing things about God. And we need to hear that. It's not flattery that God wants. It's life commitment. Notice what this man says. Darius the king wrote all the peoples and nations of men of every language, tongues, who were living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree, this is again the decree of the law, the Medes and the Persians can't be changed, that in all the dominion of my kingdom men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For He is the living God and enduring forever. That's pretty heavy theology. He didn't say He was the only God, but He said He's the ever-living God. Kind of a play on that Yahweh again. And His kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. Now look, Jerusalem was in ruins. During this period, these were national deities. And here is a statement saying His kingdom will never end. Now that's pretty far-sighted theology. He's going to have an eternal kingdom is the idea here. And His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. And you know, there's been a book recently. It's put out, I think, by... It's either Albright or Wright. I think it's Wright. Called The God Who Acts. Aren't you glad you serve a God who acts? Who acts not only in the big picture of history and nations, but is involved in the daily nitty-gritty of life, where the rubber meets the road of heartaches as well as joys? Friends, that's what he did with Daniel and his friends. Who also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Man, look at verse 28. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now this is the verse that really confuses us. Does this word and mean who is? Now there are some examples of this Hebrew word where it's used not as a compound, we would say and, or in Greek kai, but it's used in the sense of Darius, who is Cyrus. Some have thought that's what we have here. That is not the normal usage. That's one minor option in a panoply of options on this Hebrew connective. And I really don't know. I think until we have more history, we're just going to have to hold off on who is Darius and exactly his relationship to Cyrus. If I had to pick, I think Gobryas of Gudium, the governor who was appointed by Cyrus over Babylon, and Cyrus had to leave for some reason to accept what the throne or put it down a rebellion or whatever, seems to be best to me. You know, I love these early parts of Daniel. We're going to get into the difficult ones next time when it gets into apocalyptic language. But, you know, we have daily things here. Now, maybe we have been thrown in the lion's den or put in the fiery furnace, but we see faith as it walks in daily life. And we see men who are not geared to circumstances, but geared to God. We see those who trust God to the extent of their fame and fortune, and even their life is not too compared with their lifestyle, love, and faith to God. We've got something to learn from that, my friends. In a culture like ours that tries to get us to compromise at every turn, these four Hebrew boys are really an example. I wonder, what do you do in the little issues of life that compromise who you are as God's person, Christ's brother? What do you do when the little things at work or school come up and it's easier just not to make any waves than it is to stand up? The recent movie, Chariots of Fire, was a good example of a man who stands on conviction. Now, whether you agree with his conviction is not the issue. He lived up to the best light he had. We need to, too. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.